wonderful Wizard of Oz. Well, here he is, the Wizard of Wiz, if ever a Wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a Wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz is one. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the Wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is The Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series, but with a twist. My name is Smithy, and I'm from the land of Oz. In this, the third edition of Wizards, we're going to take a look at how banks bet that poverty will pay off for them. We'll be taking a close look at predatory lending, whereby banks seeking high returns prey on the poor, who, as noted in past editions of Wizards, have little to no voice in the financial system. We will also look at banks' appetites for homes through this predatory lending, followed by the foreclosure process. In this investigation of banks' activities in low-income neighbourhoods, it will be most appropriate to look at the relationship between the father of the banks, the Federal Reserve, and the poor. But before exploring this relationship between powerful creditors or money creators and low-income people, let's first review some important points learned from earlier editions of Wizards. We recall that money is created, out of thin air, by the banks and the Federal Reserve System, and is not backed by anything at all but our trust in the monetary system. We also recall from Wizards Part 2 that in the absence of anything real actually backing money, the US dollar is the backbone of the international monetary system. This trust in the US dollar is little more than a group psychological phenomenon that could collapse simply by people starting to question the faith they have in it. But because people don't stop to think about it too much, the above realization can initially cause some shock and confusion, but maybe also some hope. To get more comfortable with this very different way of looking at money and to get a better understanding of the trickery and sleights of hand at work, there is an excellent text which was written way back in 1965 that you should be aware of. It is called A Primer on Money, Banking and Gold, and I would highly recommend this to those who wish for a more detailed technical understanding of the mechanics that were described at a bit of a big picture level throughout Wizards Part 1, which was on how money is created. This book was written by a Mr. Peter Bernstein all those years ago when the monetary system was still bound to the gold standard and so was actually a bit different than it is today. Nevertheless, Mr. Bernstein, who had a long and distinguished career in the banking industry, including many years at the Federal Reserve as a researcher, wrote the best text I have ever seen on this subject. And even though the monetary system has lost its gold backing and several other key changes have been made, much of this text is still relevant today. Professor James Tobin, the Nobel Prize winner in economics and famous among activists for his Tobin tax proposals, has also given the book much praise. It's very sad that such books are not widely available nor incorporated into the core school curricula so that the monetary system could be clearly identified for what it really is. It's Mr. Bernstein himself who sums up this dilemma over educating people about the monetary system so eloquently. He says in his book that when we, quote, ask what the American dollar is really based upon, we would have to say that it exists essentially on promises and bookkeeping machines. If anyone were to set up such a system by decree or legislation, it would probably fail. Indeed, it is just as well that most people never stop to realize that the money they earn for their efforts is only a number in a bookkeeping machine, or a piece of paper convertible into nothing more than another number in a bookkeeping machine. End quote. The English word credit can be traced back to its Latin origins as being synonymous with belief, faith, confidence, and trust. While many bankers may be aware that this trust is not well founded once you get past the smoke and mirrors surrounding money or credit creation, it is certainly not in their best interest to advertise this fact. This is because the system works to their advantage. If public confidence in the monetary system is to be shaken, it will have to come from those hurt by the monetary system. But first, they themselves will have to get to the point of questioning the system they have placed their trust in. The growing abuses of credit creation powers over the poor and the growing awareness of these abuses that we will discuss in Wizards today and elsewhere in Wizards may very well act as a catalyst to get people to this realization. In this edition of Wizards, we're going to go and chat with some people at the American Association for Retired Persons, or AARP, who just gave some very informative testimony to the Senate Banking Committee about what some of the hungry banks have been up to lately. It seems that after the Asian financial crisis, the bank's appetite for foreign adventures was somewhat diminished for just a little while, and they had to look closer to home for those high return loans. The elderly must have seemed something of an attractive target market for their high equity, which is mostly in the form of home equity, but low-income profiles. Such a demographic is a prime target for what is known as equity stripping. We will talk more about equity stripping when we go visit the AARP, but to draw some parallels with early editions of Wizards, this equity stripping is very similar to what happens in foreign investing, followed by IMF bailouts, that we have spoken about in earlier editions of Wizards. The big banks and financial players, mostly of course the ones too big to fail, whose loans start to default but who cannot have the default hit their books in any great extent, need someone to get the money out from somewhere to prevent these defaults. That is when the IMF steps in with its bailout packages and austerity programs to squeeze the money out of the country that doesn't have any money, and by that I mean the so-called hard currency. The IMF completes its mission by equity stripping, which is selling off the real assets, the real physical assets of the country and labor as well, to generate cash to pay back the banks. In the domestic retail equity stripping examples we'll look at today, we'll see that this is very similar to what shady banks do directly to those easily preyed upon at home. We will also see that many of these shady operators are actually subsidiaries of the large, well-established banks like Citigroup, JP Morgan Chase, and Bank of America. Today's study of predatory lending will take us to one of the cities where abusive lending practices are some of the worst in the country, and to the state with one of the most bank-friendly foreclosure laws on the books. Interestingly, it is also the place where the Federal Trade Commission has recently filed suit against Citigroup for the predatory practices of its subsidiary, Associates First Capital, in what could become the largest and most public case against a predatory lender ever seen in this country. This location is Atlanta, Georgia.
One day we must come to see that the whole Jericho Road must be changed, so that men and women will not be constantly beaten and robbed as they make their journey on life's highway. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth with righteous indignation. It will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries and say this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America and say this is not just. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just.
These are some words from Reverend King, given at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in 1967 during his speech about the Vietnam War, which 3 years later and after his death received a Grammy Award. We'll hear some more words from his speech that was given so close to the neighborhoods and the areas where predatory lending is so prevalent in Atlanta, but as we shall see, is actually rampant throughout the entire state of Georgia and seemingly throughout the nation. Before going further into the relationship between the Federal Reserve, the commercial banks, and the poor, let's just take a look at the so-called science behind the monetary system. The predatory behavior of banks is most pronounced, of course, where they are easy targets. The easy targets are the poor. And we're not just going to focus on the relationship between the commercial banks and the poor. As noted above, we're first going to look at the relationship between the father of the banks, the Federal Reserve, and the poor. And in order to do this, we'll look at some of the underlying principles or ideas that might be influencing the behavior of those that make money. The famous extreme capitalist and private property advocate Ayn Rand, or sometimes pronounced Ayn Rand, who we mentioned in the second edition of Wizards as the author of the book Atlas Shrugged, once said, quote, "If money is the root of all evil, then what is the root of all money?" End quote. And this might make you chuckle a bit if you recall that Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, worked with her extensively on her book Atlas Shrugged, released in 1957, which many right-wingers claim to be the most influential book since the Bible. In subsequent years, Greenspan also contributed to Rand's publication known as The Objectivist. Today, Rand's protege is right at the center of all money, and perhaps her question is answered. Since money has become the backbone of so much of our social fabric, and it is, after all is said and done, just based on faith and belief in it, we had better know something about the beliefs of those at the center of it. That Greenspan has a long history in the banking and finance sectors, including the obligatory stint at J.P. Morgan, is hardly surprising in the world of central bankers. What is perhaps more worthy of attention is his service to Rand in her work. This is evidence of his rigorous training in her philosophy, which is known as objectivism, and whose fundamental features seem to overlap extensively with today's so-called neoliberal economic policy. The philosophy of objectivism largely rejects the idea that capitalism and capitalists should have any social goals at all, and promotes the idea that all acts and intentions should be purely selfish. Not surprisingly, Rand's work was a huge hit with the powers that be in America at the time, hot on the heels of the McCarthy era. Her ideas are actually very different to Adam Smith's philosophy, but we're not going to go into that here. In coming up with her rather extreme but very influential theories, it appears that Miss Rand must have been skipping her physics lessons. If she had bothered to look into the revolutionary developments in physics that took place in the early 1900s in the form of quantum mechanics and special relativity, her philosophy may have hit some stumbling blocks. Both of these radical developments in physics shook the foundations of Western thought premised on objectivity, independence of objects, and the absolute nature of time, and certainty. Gradually, this way of looking at the world, which has many parallels with Eastern religions, has replaced the old Newtonian mechanics of looking at the world in the study of physics, and is seeping its way into other sciences such as chemistry and biology. A fabulous text on these developments in physics and their parallels with Eastern philosophy, and written very well for the layperson, is the book called The Tao of Physics by Dr. Fridtjof Capra and written in 1975. These days it seems that students of business and economics are also too busy to attend physics classes, and this is one of the problems with having isolated disciplines of study. Today it is the economists, business people and politicians who are the furthest behind in picking up on these turn-of-the-century revolutionary developments in science. The only thing they gleaned from this scientific revolution was a knowledge of how to make the atomic bomb and blow things up in a spectacular fashion. But what they could have learned is some pretty interesting flaws in their own field of economics. Not only are today's mainstream economic theories and philosophies like objectivism outdated by being based on the old Newtonian or classical worldview, but these same outdated views are reflected in our current monetary system. Nothing illustrates this better than having a disciple of Rand at the helm of the Federal Reserve. This digression into modern physics, while talking about the relationship between the Fed and the poor, may seem rather odd. Nevertheless, it brings home the point that money is a social and psychological phenomenon, and so the beliefs and so-called science adopted by those that create and control money must be scrutinized. In later editions of Wizards, we are going to explore further some of the foundations of contemporary mainstream economic theory that are challenged by the worldview shift brought about by modern physics that the economists have yet to pick up on. It is rather ironic that mainstream economics, claiming to be so scientifically based, completely ignores the developments in the most objective science of all. The emerging field of so-called ecological economics is doing a much better job of incorporating modern physics. We'll just note here that these changes in perspective, long incorporated into Eastern philosophy, force us to think about time differently, to always acknowledge the interconnectedness of everything, and to recognize ever-present uncertainty in everything. The private property markets of today do not operate in this fashion. Rather, they treat people and objects as independent economic units and discount the future as less important than the present. Furthermore, they have very limited mechanisms for coping with uncertainty.
It happens to be symptomatic of a deeper malady in the American spirit. In 1957, a sensitive American official overseas said that it seemed to him that our nation was on the wrong side of a world revolution, increasingly by choice or by accident. This is a role our nation has taken, the role of those who make peaceful revolutions impossible by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that comes from the immense profits of overseas investments. Now, I'm convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin to shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our present policies.
Let's move on to talk more specifically about the relationship between the Federal Reserve and the poor. Under the old world view, central bankers use more or less traditional techniques for exercising some control over the economy, and a large part of this is maintaining the confidence of the markets in the monetary system. So people that don't have much money don't factor into central bankers' decisions very much at all. On the surface, many might think that there is no relationship between the Federal Reserve and the poor to speak of. However, this ignores the interconnectedness of everything, and this is perhaps best considered within the context of the zero-sum game that we spoke about in Wizards Part 1. As income and wealth gaps have widened, fewer people have more and more money, and the majority of the people are getting less. Many of those that have accumulated lots of money go looking for lots of places to invest it, or gamble with it, so that it will make more. This has led to an explosion in non-bank financial institutions and the use of corporate bonds and other such instruments in lending. None of these mechanisms create money out of thin air because the players don't have a banking license. But because the players have accumulated so much of the existing money, they can become financiers themselves by lending out the piles of dough they've accumulated. Thus, according to Martin Meyer in the book The Fed, only 1/5 of commercial and industrial financing now comes from the banks. The rest comes from people and non-bank institutions that have accumulated lots of the existing money. This has several implications. First, the Fed's powers over the market is more limited because there are so many non-bank financiers, so that the Fed has to do whatever it can to please these non-bank markets and keep their confidence in the whole financial system alive. By necessity, this means always pleasing the people that already have lots of money. Second, banks go looking all over the place for new people and entities to lend to, since the domestic non-bank corporations have abandoned them pretty much. This search has been a big part of banks' overseas lending adventures and the phenomenal growth in lending to the subprime domestic markets over the past decade. The subprime market is people with bad credit histories, which correlates well with low income earners and low wealth groups. This loan market has grown 300% from about $75 billion in 1993 to over $300 billion by the year 2000, and this is according to the Wall Street Journal. Previously, the banks wouldn't touch this market with a 10-foot pole, but in their never-ending search for new borrowers, especially at high yields, this has become a huge growth area. In past years, the practice of redlining has been common amongst banks, whereby banks mark maps with a red marker for areas they would and would not lend to, and these distinctions were often made along racial lines. These days, a similar map marking process might be used to distinguish between prime and subprime target markets, that is, who gets access to credit on reasonable terms and who gets lumped into the subprime category, which is where the most exploitative terms of credit prevail. Public concern over discriminatory practices in lending and the limited availability of credit in poorer neighbourhoods led to the passing of the Community Reinvestment Act, or CRA, in 1977, under which bank examiners are supposed to check banks' records of meeting the credit needs of the entire community, including low to middle income groups. This means that the Federal Reserve does have some responsibility for this, but as already noted, the Fed is mostly concerned with monetary policy, which means making sure that the people that have the most money keep confidence in the monetary system. So, as Martin Meyer points out in the book The Fed, quote, discrimination against low-income people in lending operations was a subject guaranteed to be of no interest to the Federal Reserve system, end quote. And as Kenneth Thomas, a Wharton School lecturer on finance, points out, quote, banks are always happy with the ratings given by the easiest CRA grader in the business, end quote, meaning that the Federal Reserve doesn't take the CRA review of banks too seriously at all. Martin Meyer also notes in the book The Fed that, quote, both publicly and privately, the Fed has always refused to acknowledge the existence of discrimination in any part of the American banking system, end quote. Consistent with this observation, the Fed has behaved rather antisocially during the approval process for mergers and acquisitions with respect to complaints filed with it regarding unfair and exploitative lending practices. Basically, it has ignored consumer complaints and public concerns, and nowhere was this more noticeable than during Citigroup's recent acquisition of the huge Mexican banking group, Banamex. The July 30th edition of the American Banker Daily Paper reported, in reference to the Greenlining Coalition's request for a hearing on the takeover, that, quote, comparing the Fed's approval to Alice in Wonderland, where a verdict is reached before the trial, the San Francisco-based umbrella group for 37 religious, minority and ethnic organizations said the hastily crafted approval would embarrass even an old-style banana republic regime. End quote. That same issue of American Banker contained another story about Citigroup's alleged gag orders on ex-employees about abusive and fraudulent practices in its subprime lending unit. We can hardly be surprised by all this when, after all, Citigroup is the largest shareholder of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and its CEO is on this Fed Bank's board. The relationships between the Fed and the big banks are all just too cozy for public comfort. In an observation that would meet with approval in the Rand School of Thought, Martin Meyer concludes in his book that, quote, there are people in high places who still believe government should not interfere with the freedom of contract between the loan shark and the needy, end quote. Before closing out this section on the relationship between the Fed and the poor, we should just note the interesting results of one of Mr. Greenspan's recent data analysis projects. The June 4, 2001 edition of Business Week reported on a study commissioned by the Fed that found that 50% of consumer spending in the year 2000 was attributable to the top 20% of income earners. This was consistent with results throughout the 1990s. Also, amazingly, 80% of directly held equity or stocks was attributable to the top 20% bracket. The conclusion of the study was that the economic boom of the middle to late 1990s was almost entirely driven by the spending of the top 20% of earners, whose spending was in turn driven by confidence derived from an inflated equity market. Now that the markets are sliding, the spending has stopped, we are sliding into a recession, and layoffs are increasing in response to low company earnings. What then is the Federal Reserve Chairman to do? It seems his role is to keep the stock markets up and keep the top 20%, i.e. the speculator class, happy. So maybe it's not just that the poor are irrelevant to the Fed's decisions, but the irrelevancy may run as high as 80% of the American people, and not to mention the rest of the world. Now we're going to look at some detail at the relationship between the commercial banks and the poor by going into a case study centered in Atlanta, Georgia.
Well, the devil went down to Georgia. He was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind. He was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man, sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, boy, let me tell you what. Probably didn't even know it, but I'm a fiddle player too. And if you care to take a dare, I'll just make a bet with you. Now you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but let's give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul, I think I'm better than you. Boy said, my name's Johnny, and it might be a sin, but I'm gonna take your bet, you're gonna regret I'm the best as ever been. Johnny, you're rising up, you're blowing, play your fiddle hard. Cause you're floating in Georgia, and the devil deals cards. If you win, you'll get the shiny fiddle. But if you lose, the devil gets your soul.
Let's just look at a little bit of background of the Georgia predatory lending extravaganza, and then we're going to go and speak with some people at the American Association for Retired Persons. As reported in the July 3rd American Banker, on June 28th, 2001, Georgia's second largest county, DeKalb County, which is in the Atlanta area, enacted an ordinance restricting county agencies from depositing money in banks identified as predatory. Under this ordinance, banks are required to report information such as interest rates and charges on individual loans. The bankers immediately balked at this and headed over to the Georgia State Capitol, where they thought they would be well looked after. The Georgia bankers were taking a page from the book of the Pennsylvania bankers, who managed to have a similar Philadelphia local ordinance killed at the state level. And much to my surprise, as we're going to see in the following interview with Kathy Floyd, the advocacy director at the American Association for Retired Persons in Atlanta, Georgia, the bankers also went straight away and took DeKalb County to court to get a restraining order on this local regulation. In the following interview with Kathy Floyd at the American Association of Retired Persons, we will talk about this court case. And in the interview, we didn't have the name of the association that had filed the lawsuit, but we did find out that it was not a local or a state group, but a large national association of financial services companies. Later on, I found out that the group that filed the lawsuit against a county was the American Financial Service Association. So I went to their website trying to find out, well, who are the members of this organization that just filed suit against a county for a local ordinance? And the members appear to be very large financial, multinational financial institutions, though the website would not let me see who the members were without being a member of the organization myself. However, it did give me the directors, and as I recall, the directors were from companies such as American General and the Ford Credit Corporation. I suspect that other members may also be large financial institutions who have just taken county to court over a local ordinance and have been successful in getting a restraining order on that ordinance. The following concepts and definitions may help listeners to better understand some of the terminology used in the following interview. A subprime loan is a loan made to someone with poor credit history and therefore often incurs a higher interest rate than someone who qualifies for a prime loan. A real asset, referred to in the following interview, means a real physical asset such as a house or a car. The practice of equity stripping refers to the practice whereby a loan is made and secured or guaranteed to guaranteed by a real asset. And what this means is if the borrower ever gets into problems with repaying their loan, then that real asset will be used to, say, be liquidated or sold to generate the cash that can pay off the loan. So when we say equity stripping, that practice often refers to the situation where interest rates and charges built into a loan are so severe that it will probably end up in a, or it may end up in a situation where the borrower cannot repay the loan and therefore ends up using the equity or ownership that they once held in their real asset that gets liquidated to pay off the loan. Now we're going to go to this interview with Kathy Floyd, the advocacy director at the American Association of Retired Persons, based in Atlanta, Georgia. The American Association of Retired Persons recently gave testimony to the Senate Banking Committee on Predatory Lending. Could you tell us why the Senate decided to conduct this hearing and what were some of the things that the AARP spoke about in their testimony?
The reason that we had this hearing really was you can trace it back to the change in the leadership in the Senate. When the Democrats took back control of the Senate, the banking chairs changed. And the new banking chair, Sarbanes, is committed to some legislation to try and address some of the abusive practices with predatory mortgage lending. And so as soon as he got the chairmanship, he said he was planning to have some hearings on the issue, and that's where the hearings came from. We were one of the groups that testified. We have made this a priority issue for AARP to try and get We really focus now at the state level because that's where most of the activity is going on. It would be much better to have federal legislation, but it's not likely anytime soon to have federal legislation. But we were there testifying, talking about the kinds of abuses that we see and the things that could be done to address these abuses.
When the AARP gave testimony, what were some of the main things that they spoke about? What were their main concerns?
Well, we are concerned that this is affecting older people. We are seeing this because older people tend to own their own home. They tend to own older homes. These older homes tend to need repairs. And because they're older, they're less likely to do the repairs themselves. So all of those factors lead into a perfect target for a predatory lender. A lot of these loans start out as home repairs. And people will go and knock on elderly folks' doors. They'll go up to them. We've heard of people that went up to them on their porch and said, it looks like you need a roof repair, looks like you need a new paint job, new storm windows, the whole gamut. And they give them an estimate. And, of course, the older person says, well, you know, I don't have the money to pay for this. And they say, we'll take care of it. And before you know it, they've got a $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 loan on their home, and the repairs may or may not get done, and they may not be done well.
Does the person with the home know that this other person is from a bank, and do they think they're a repair person?
Oftentimes they do not understand until they get to the table and are signing papers, and they may not understand at that point that they're putting their home at risk.
So what ends up happening, people that take these loans out, say it's a $20,000 loan, mm-hmm. How do they get to the point, is it because of the interest rates that are charged, that if these interest rates were at the prime level, say currently maybe around 7% or so, would the same thing end up happening? Is it the interest rates that are causing this, or is it the fact that these people just basically can't afford these loans?
We've seen some high interest rates in some of the cases that I've seen. We have seen some high interest rates, and that can definitely be a problem. You'll also see the old bait and switch, where they'll be promised what sounds to them a reasonable interest rate, and then when they actually get to signing the paper, it'll be a much higher interest rate. But it's not just a problem of high interest rates. They're doing what is called packing, which is they are selling products with this mortgage that the people don't need. And one of those products, one of the most abusive products, is single premium credit life insurance. Mm-hmm. I've got some documents here of a woman that when she got her loan, bought single premium credit life, disability insurance, all on a loan, and all paid up front, financed into the loan. So there, where she may have had a repair job that was actually $5,000, she's bought an additional $5,000 of life insurance, $3,000 of disability insurance. The points are outrageous.
And just so that listeners can understand, why do these people need to buy life insurance and disability insurance?
Well, I've heard from victims that they get to the table, they have no idea that this is included until they get to the table and they'll see a figure there and they'll ask, what is this? Mm-hmm. And the lender will explain to them that it's for their protection, which is false. It actually protects the lender. I heard from one lady who said, I don't have any children. I don't have anybody that would take up the payments for my loan, so I needed this life insurance, credit life insurance. That's exactly the wrong case.
Right.
You do that to protect your loved ones that want to hold on to the house. You don't do it if
so
you don't have any loved ones.
If something happened to you, you're worried about the loan being paid off so that you can keep the house.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. Correct. There are some people that say that credit life is, a useless product altogether. But it is definitely abusive to pay for it all up front.
Mm-hmm.
It makes much more sense if you're going to buy the product to have the premiums over time, to pay for it over time. So the most abusive practice is paying the single premium up front. And a huge part of that premium, if you talk to insurance companies that are selling it, is a commission,
mm-hmm.
Straight off
right.
the top.
Now, you've just spoken about how the companies actually go about and target these markets. And that technique involved actually looking for people that need home repairs.
Right.
Can you talk about some of the other ways that these lenders go after?
You also see in poor neighborhoods the placards up on telephone poles, consolidate your credit. You see on TV on some of the cable channels. There are ads running. I've had several of our members send me email messages. That's a new way now that they're sending out email messages to people about consolidating their loans.
What about telemarketing?
Yes. A lot of telemarketing going on, calling people up on the phone and telling them that they have. They can lower their interest rate, consolidate their payments, solve all their financial problems.
In past years, it's certainly been well known that banks have used the practice of redlining, where they would target certain neighborhoods and mark on maps. These are the neighborhoods that I'm going to offer credit to, and these are the neighborhoods I'm not going to offer credit to. The situation now seems to be that practice of redlining may be continuing, but instead of credit versus no credit, it's subprime credit versus prime credit. Can you talk about that? Is that a correct observation? And is there any kind of racial profiling going on that you see?
Well, you can see if you look at a correlation between where subprime loans are and where you're seeing high rates of foreclosure and minority neighborhoods. I know HUD has done some studies, and in the Atlanta area there is some correlation. It's like reverse redlining. But we are really seeing this going on across Georgia, and we are hearing from all kinds of victims, young and old, across Georgia.
You've talked about the credit insurance as a way that banks basically end up, I guess, stripping equity out of the home with these loans, and,
right.
and part of it is through the financing of credit insurance and the high interest rates. I wanted to talk about some of the other techniques. When we talk about equity stripping, is that basically what it is, or is there anything else to equity stripping?
You can also strip equity out of a person's home by flipping their loan several times.
And what does that mean?
It means that the person will have refinanced their home 3, 4, 5 times over a 6-7 year period.
And why have they refinanced?
Well, what can happen is they are a loan is written the first time, and in that loan they may have the high points, the single premium credit life insurance premium, also you will see prepayment penalties. And these can be, you know, 5 points the first year, 4 points, 3 points. They may go down so that that lender within the first year will call that person back and say, maybe, you know, your loan has a 14% interest rate. You may be having trouble. Let's get back in here, and I'm going to give you a 12.5% interest rate. And the person may think, well, that'll be a help to me. And they get them back in, they do a new loan, they don't realize they've got to pay that 5% prepayment penalty. They've got to, they'll stack on more points. They may charge them 5, 6, 7 points to do the refinancing. And another technique that they use is they'll put a balloon in there. You know, say they do the second loan, and maybe 12, 15 months later, they'll call them back and say, you know, we got your interest payment down, your interest rate down, but your payment didn't go down that much, did it? Let's get your payment down. Mm-hmm. And they'll come in with a new loan, and they'll have to pay prepayment penalties again, and they may get their payment down a little bit. But what they won't realize until they're signing the papers, and they may not even realize it then, is they'll stick a balloon on the end. 15 years, they may owe, you know, this big sum of money.
So, just for the listeners to understand, the balloon payment is that's basically a big amount of loan principal that's due right at the end of the loan.
Correct. So if you say, you know, your mortgage payment's $350 a month, and it's over 15 years, and then all of a sudden you've got a $50,000 balloon that's due at the end of the period for you to get out of your loan.
So would you see that cause a lot of the foreclosure problems where the people get to the end of the loan and hadn't realized that there was this balloon payment? And
usually that can be a problem. A lot of times they're in trouble before they even get to that point.
Okay.
Because what will happen is this lender has already refinanced them a couple times, and then they'll call them back again 6 months later and say, do you realize you've got a balloon? How are you ever going to be able to pay this?
Mm-hmm.
They get them back in again and refinance them again.
Mm-hmm.
And each time their balance grows, that's stripping equity out of the home.
So really what's happening is these people are becoming more and more indebted as time goes by and approaching the point where the only thing that can pay off the loan is their real asset.
Correct. We saw when we had with the legislation that we supported through Senator Ford, we had some public hearings last fall, and a couple that live right here in Decatur had a particularly bad case. They had been flipped 5 or 6 times, and the loan documents that they got from the lender in a lawsuit, because they were able to get some representation, showed that the lender had written the top of their documents, they always pay on time.
I'd like to talk just a little bit about, there's a number of lawsuits and class action lawsuits that have been going on. Citigroup acquired a subsidiary, Associates First Capital, which was known as one of the worst predatory lenders in the country, actually, and one of the largest, as I understand it. Do you know anything? There was a class action lawsuit filed in the state of Georgia, and I'm kind of curious to know what that lawsuit was about. What's the basis of that lawsuit, and what was the end result of that lawsuit?
They did settle the lawsuit. It was almost 2,000 loans originating in Georgia by the associates, and it was settled earlier this year. And the key issue with this loan was that all of these loans had single premium credit life insurance, and I think that was, and because there's been so much attention on the issue, that helped in pushing them to settle the case. What was helpful for us is we were able to get the information from the lawsuit of where these loans were made in Georgia, and we have I have a spreadsheet here of the loans, and Georgia has 159 counties, and these loans were made in I think 124 counties in Georgia. So we talk to a lot of people in Georgia that will say, well, this is just an Atlanta problem, or this is just an urban problem. And I think this information proves that this is going on across Georgia. It was very helpful to show some of our rural legislators that their counties were included in here. And this was just, this is just one lender.
Right. You just spoke about how an extraordinary high proportion of Georgia counties is affected by one company, by one predatory lender, and so obviously predatory lending is just rampant in Georgia. Is this particular to Georgia? Is it all over the nation? Is it particularly bad in the southern states? If this is a case. This is often a case of targeting minorities, targeting low-income people. Is it particularly worse in the southern states, or is it just, do you just think it's all over the country?
Well, I know that with AARP, we have major campaigns going on in California, New York, Ohio, and some other states are starting their campaigns. So we are seeing it go on across the country. I know that Georgia, with the HUD data, was coming up as one of the worst places. But
and HUD means?
The Housing and Urban Development, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. They held a field hearing here in Georgia in early 2000, and released some data that showed the correlation between the high foreclosure and low-income minority neighborhoods.
There is an interesting type of loan, and I'm not sure if groups like Associates First Capital, who is now a subsidiary of Citigroup, and some of the other subprime subsidiaries of the large banks like Bank of America and JP Morgan Chase. I'm not sure if they're involved in this, but I'm wondering if you can give us an overview of what is known as the payday loan market and who the players are in it. First of all, how do those payday loans work, and who are the players in the payday loans?
This is another priority for us. This is another example of predatory lending. Payday loans are originally based as a until payday kind of loan. And what happens is a person will go into one of these buildings and write a check for, say, $100. And the loan term can be a week, 2 weeks. It can be as short as a day. And the they write a check for $100. They walk out of the door with $85, and the store will hold that check until the agreed upon time. It's a week, 2 weeks. I've never heard of a case of more than 2 weeks. The longest is 2 weeks, and then they cash the check. So you're if you're looking at a 2 week period, then that's almost 400% interest. If you figure it.
I guess I don't understand. They're coming in with these people coming in with no money, or they have $100 in their bank account.
No, that's the deal. They don't have $100 in their bank account.
Okay.
And what happens generally is at the end of the week.
No money.
Correct. They come in and they write a check, and the store.
Against their next pay?
That's kind of the idea, is that you'll get paid next week and there'll be money in the account and they can cash the check.
Okay. So it's a done deal at that point, is that
They have no money in their account, and the payday loan giver knows that. So they will not cash the check until that person gets paid into their...
Well, what they won't cash it until the agreed upon time.
Right. And at which point there should be money in the account. So they can... They're expecting the money to be in the account.
Correct.
So they can take the $100 and the person had only gotten $85.
Correct.
Okay. And what happens if the money isn't in the account?
That is what usually happens, is that there's not money in the account, and the person will come back in the store and either roll it over, which is they'll say, I want you to continue to hold that check, and they give them another $15. Mm-hmm. Or if, if there's some prohibitions against rollovers, which sometimes the payday lenders will say, we don't allow rollovers, or we only allow four rollovers, that kind of thing, which is just a farce, because all you've got to do is write a new check, mm-hmm. Which is a new transaction.
Right.
So there have been studies in other states that show an average of 6 to 11 of these taken out a year.
Then who are the players in this payday loan? In terms of, are they like these Associates First Cap? Are they subsidiaries of banks, or are they other types of operators?
They're other types of operators.
Okay. Do they need any kind of special license to do what they're doing? I mean, they're obviously, if they're other operators, you're saying they don't have a banking license?
Well, there are several states that have passed, the industry has been able to pass legislation which gives them special operating situations.
Where some kind of operating license today?
Right. Like in North Carolina, they passed a bill a couple of years ago, and it actually sunset last Friday. And it allowed them to... operate with, they had to get a license, and they were able to charge certain rates. And the industry has tried to pass a bill in Georgia for a number of years now, because Georgia has a usury rate cap of 60%. And that would apply to their transactions. But they're trying to get out from under that cap and say that this is not a an interest rate that's being charged.
Do other states have usury laws, and is it unusual to see usury capped at a huge 60%?
Several other states do still have usury laws, and I think they range across the board. I know there are other states that have really high ones too.
How much power do these payday lenders have in the Georgia legislature? Is it likely that they may succeed?
They've come close 3 years now, mm-hmm. And we have worked with other consumer groups to fight this legislation, and we know that we will be fighting it again next year also. In Florida, they just passed a compromise bill, and we'll see how it works.
What's a compromise bill?
Well, you agree that there'll be, I think some of the compromises are, you agree that there'll be only so many rollovers. Another popular compromise now is a registry where... Because what people will do is they'll max out at one payday lender, and they'll go down the street to another one and another one. You hear horror stories of especially military personnel that get sucked into this, and they'll be juggling five, six different payday lenders, and taking one out to pay the other. And so one of the ideas is you have a registry, so you know who has loans out and who doesn't. Of course, what some states have run into is they make this compromise and they allow them to operate, and then nobody wants to pay for the registry. Mm-hmm. That's a problem. Nobody wants to pay to keep it up and maintain it and
right.
do the work that's necessary to keep it effective.
Uh-huh.
One of the complications for this issue is if you want to operate in Georgia or some of these states where it is illegal to do this, you can sign up with a nationally chartered bank, mm-hmm. and you're not subject to Georgia's usury cap.
Oh, are you seeing that happen?
Yes.
That happening?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, that's quite interesting. So then these payday lenders are becoming affiliated with the national banks, with the big national banks.
Well, there's some national banks that are, you know, going after this business.
Right.
They're not the big ones, but there's some national banks that are going after this business because it can be very lucrative. I talked to a credit counselor in South Georgia at the beginning of the year, and she said she's talked to a woman that works at a small storefront that deposits $250,000 a week.
I've been doing some of my own calculations, both for payday loans and the subprime, like mortgage and home equity loans, to figure out how the banks are coming up with the interest rates they charge, and I'm unable to get to the high level that they come up with. Have the banks been, and the other lenders, like the payday lenders, have they been forthcoming with the way that they calculate their interest rates and the way that they calculate their fees, or is this a bit of a mystery?
Well, I know specifically with the payday loan industry, in some of the arguments, they've said that they have high credit risk and this is necessary to cover the credit risk. And there have been a few instances where consumer groups have been able to get their financials and seen that that they actually have a fairly low default ratio. So
the rates don't justify the default. So there's just a huge, great big profit in there for the lender. Right?
There's huge profit in predatory lending. I think we can say that there is a huge profit in predatory lending.
Right, and as it appears that the legislation is not taking that approach at all to date in terms of. The justification for the subprime rate is obviously the high default rate, but the default, basically what you're saying is that the default rate doesn't justify that level of...
In the payday loans, we've definitely seen that, and what the payday loan operator has is, if you've got a week, it's due in a week, and you wanted to pay another $15, what they'll argue is, okay, you can give me 15, or I'm going to deposit this check, and the bank will charge you 25. And that's an immediate argument that people will, they'll pick the 15
right.
instead of the 25,
right.
And not thinking, next week I'm going to pay another 15. Next week I'm going to have to pay another 15.
And another thing that's quite interesting is that. One of the reasons that the defaults are low is because the banks are not properly doing their risk assessment. So in a way that they're actually assessing risk as worse than they are, so that people that could have qualified for a prime loan are actually getting a subprime loan. And that is surely another reason why the actual default experience does not justify these kinds of rates.
Right. We know that the chairman of Fannie Mae said earlier this year that nearly a third of the borrowers who receive subprime loans could have qualified for a traditional mortgage. So, which makes sense when you know that these people are, they're not shopping for these loans. People are calling them on the phone, sending them flyers, going up, knocking on their doors to offer them these deals. So this is not a case of a consumer shopping and getting the best rates.
And it may not even, it sounds like from when we started this interview, it's not even a case of a need having really been identified.
Correct.
But people coming up and convincing them that there's a need for this loan.
Correct.
So the response of the city and state bodies have been quite active in passing their own ordinances and local laws to curtail the predatory lending. And I think an interesting case that we're discussing in this issue of the Wizards of Money was a case where DeKalb County passed an ordinance or something, that it would not do business with banks identified as predatory, and that it was requiring banks to list the interest rates and various other information about loans it had given in the county. The banks really responding at both state and federal levels and going to their friends that they've given lots of campaign money to and trying to get this these local rules passed.
We've seen with the DeKalb ordinance, there is a group of subprime lenders that have filed a lawsuit against DeKalb, and they've actually gotten a judge to issue a temporary restraining order so that DeKalb is not at this point able to put their ordinance into use. Will be interesting to see how that lawsuit, how that progresses. There is a ordinance before the Atlanta City Council, a similar ordinance to the DeKalb ordinance, and I think next week that will come up again. And of course, they're watching what has happened in DeKalb, and we are. We're watching that situation. In fact, we're investigating ways to see how AARP can help, because we do in some cases write amicus briefs, friend of the court, to help, and we are interested in helping DeKalb if we can. At the state level, bankers were very active during the last legislature with the legislation that was proposed, and they are working working on this legislation. Definitely, they are definitely a player with this legislation.
So they're trying to get some bank-friendly legislation.
Well, I think in their case, they're they're better off if nothing gets passed.
Right. Okay.
And it's always easier to kill a bill than it is to get a bill passed.
So their approach is to go at DeKalb through the courts and hope that the state doesn't limit their powers as well.
Right. And the group that filed the lawsuit, their feeling is that DeKalb is trying to regulate banks, which city municipalities are not allowed to do that. County city are not allowed to do that. And DeKalb's contention is that that's not what they're doing, that they are strictly saying we are deciding who the county government is going to do business with.
Who filed the lawsuit? What was the group? Was it Georgia
Bankers? No, it's a national organization.
Oh, do you know what the group is?
I can get that name for you.
The banks come back with, when people complain about their predatory practices, the banks come back with, well, where else are these people going to get credit from? You know, we're providing a service. If we can't make a profit, then we'll pull out, and credit's going to dry up in the subprime markets. I mean, we've already seen that they're not only making a profit, but they're making they're making a killing, it seems. Do you have any reaction to that? And I guess the solution to that is, or one of the solutions to that is, could be that, that there are some better, more responsible lenders out there.
Right, and we are not in favor of drying up credit. That's not what we support at all. The legislation that we supported is based on a national model. Legislation based on this model passed in North Carolina in 1999, and it is a measured approach to addressing this problem. And we've seen it work in North Carolina, and that's what we were trying to do in Georgia. And it is our contention that if for the banks that are good players and are the good guys, that this should not be a problem. Should
so
not be a problem for them.
Good guys?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
Well, that's good to know. One last question. The current economic climate, within the current economic climate, it, you know, certainly appears that we are heading into a recession. And what's happening is that a lot of the people who have been targeted by these predatory lenders are losing their jobs, and we're also in an environment in post-welfare reform. So they're starting to default, and it's fairly well documented in the business press that a lot of these loans are starting to default. What do you think will happen? First of all, are you noticing any trends coming out of that, like basically increased foreclosure and banks getting heavy-handed with trying to make collections? And, you know, do you think that the banks will actually want to try and pull out altogether out of the subprime market?
This is also new that I haven't seen any numbers. What I know is anecdotally that we're continuing to see people that are victims. We're continuing to hear of people that are have been approached. We have an education campaign going on right now. We're trying to get information out to our members that if they're looking to borrow against their home, if they're looking for home improvements, if they're looking to consolidate their debt, anything that's going to involve putting their home on the line, that they get, we have a borrower's kit that we're asking people to get, and it has some pointers, some things to look out for, some easy worksheets to use to help them shop and see whether you know, they're doing a good thing or not. And so we do have a massive education campaign going on right now. We have a great deal of information at our website, www.aarp.org/homeloans, and that's how you get to our area specifically with borrower tips. We see, like I say, we see it anecdotally. You know, if we have a case where people are tightening their belts with salaries, you know, older people on Social Security are on fixed incomes. So they, you know, they'll continue to be targets for these loans. Mm-hmm. And what we see with, you know, a lot of our members is they, you know, they're going to pay their bills as long as they possibly can. So
they're actually a very good credit risk. They're very responsible, yeah.
Right.
Actually, I'll just ask you one more question as we close. Could you talk a little bit about your special day that's coming up in September to basically teach people about predatory lending and how to avoid
Right. We have volunteers around Georgia that are trained to speak on this issue. In addition to our speakers, we have targeted September 16th as Predatory Lending Sunday. And we have over 300 churches in Georgia that are going to be handing out materials to their parishioners of information on what to look out for, how to get more information, and we have ministers that are committed to this and hoping really to help save the homes of some of their parishioners. So that's one of the things we have going on. We also have two weekends in October designated where we have college students from colleges around Georgia that will be going to neighborhoods that that possibly may be targeted and giving out our information. We're doing a counter-strike and trying to hit some of the same people that the predatory lenders may hit and give them some information. We've got, like I say, college students around the state that are committed to handing that information out on two Saturdays in October.
Since this is an audio show, could you just describe what I have in my hand?
This is one of the things that we're using with our campaign. It is a old-fashioned hand fan, and our slogan is, "They didn't tell me I could lose my home."
And why are you giving out fans for these churches?
Well, in Georgia, we still have a number of churches that don't have air conditioning, and it's even though it's September, it's still hot in Georgia, and so we'll be giving out these fans during the services.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And we'll be following this issue very closely on the Wizards of Money.
Thank you.
And that's all for Wizards of Money Part 3. Please note that the Wizards of Money now has a website, and that's located at www.wizardsofmoney.org.
That's how we lock a day away in the middle.